Guardian Unlimited.
Hola, Prenanda, bienvenue, and welcome. I'm James Randerson, and this is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Your regular host, Alok Jha's, off this week, probably preening himself and brushing his hair. Anyway, that's a whole other story. Let's get things started, shall we? On today's show, a mixture of sex, death, and, well, everything in between. Forget raging hormones and dodgy chat-up lines, we'll be discussing the science of flirting with a cultural anthropologist and a lure therapist. Plus, Houston, we have a problem. Of the heart. We'll be bringing you the full story of NASA's space-based love triangle. And we'll also be asking what right archaeologists have digging up bones that are thousands of years old. And if that weren't enough, our very own troubadour Johnny Berliner returns to the pod for a musical interpretation of the week's other science news. Pucker up, people. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. I'm delighted to announce a double first in the pod today. Yep, for the first time this year, we have not one but two ladies in the studio. But perhaps compensating for those unprecedented levels of estrogen, we also have three beards. So, representing the fairer sex, we have Nell Bowes from Guardian Unlimited's arts blog, and Jean Smith, a cultural anthropologist at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. And representing the beards, we have producer Ben Green and troubadour physicist Johnny Berliner, and mine's the other one. Last but not least, we also have Guardian's tech correspondent, Mr. Bobby Johnson. And last time I checked, he was neither bearded nor a lady, so sorry to disappoint there. Anyway, Podders, this is our Valentine's Day special, so please give me some love.
Hello. Just me.
That's the least amount of love I've ever had. Anyway, I don't know about you, but there's definitely some sort of a... there's some kind of aroma in here, isn't there? Can anyone smell that? It's a kind of sweet... lovely, sweet smell. Bobby, can you smell that?
There's something going on.
Yes, Alok's not here, but that gay disco anthem's just for you, big guy. With Valentine's Day just around the corner, we feel duty-bound to explore the deeper issues involved in love and the business of securing the affections of that special someone. You know, the one you've been exchanging seductive glances with across a busy laboratory. So, who better to ask about this than a lady who spent most of the last decade studying flirting techniques and human interaction around the globe? Jean Smith, welcome to the pod.
Hello.
tell us more about your research.
Well, I wanted to find out if there was a difference in the way that people flirted depending on their culture. So I did research in Dublin, London, Stockholm, Paris, New York, and Chicago, and I interviewed singles about their flirting habits. And I found, indeed, there were definitely differences in the way people flirted.
And what sort of things are different?
Well, we should start what was the same, and that was eye contact. In all of these cultures, eye contact was the most important thing. And if you're talking about the Parisians, they have about 25 different kinds of eye contact that they mentioned. And if you're talking about New York females, their eye contact was looking a man up and down, which you probably wouldn't find here in London. Yeah. I think I should quickly tell all the men listening out there that if a woman gives you eye contact, this is the equivalent of a male walking up and saying, you know, hey, babe, can I buy you a drink? This is really, really powerful. And I think men don't understand how powerful this is.
Well, nobody's giving me eye contact in this pod at the moment, but I've got a feeling that that Bobby's got a question.
So who are the best flirts in the world then, in your experience?
Okay, this is a really interesting question, because who are the best in the world? Then in my experience, I like the way that the Irish people flirt. But that's because I'm a big fan of humor. But if you ask that, for example, to my over 200 interviewees who I did ask that question to, it turns out that most people like the people in their own country. They prefer the way that their own country people flirt with them, and it's because they know the rules. For example, if you take the Parisian women, they show interest by not showing interest, by ignoring the person they're interested in. Now, if you were a London male, as you are, going to Paris, how would you know that because this woman is ignoring you, that she's interested in you?
Well, that explains the rudeness of French women, then.
They're all deeply in love with you.
Yeah. So, Jean, what's the difference in the way that men and women flirt?
Okay. Well, that can probably, the answer can be found in the definition of flirting. And that was the first question I asked people, is what is your definition of flirting? And surprise, surprise, it turns out that, again, generally speaking, men flirt for a means to an end, and women flirt just as a fun way of communicating.
Right. Nell, you've got a question, I think.
I'm not sure women don't flirt with a means to an end myself, but what did you measure? Is this just questionnaires and or surveys of people's own opinions?
Yeah, these were about 1 to 2 hour face-to-face interviews with each of these people. And then it also consisted of me being a participant observer in the flirting cultures. And I observed two different kinds of flirting, the day-to-day and also the evening flirting, like the more traditional nightclub scene. It was really hard work.
And did you only look at singles, or do you look at flirting in...
Well, the category is so broad that even just looking at singles aged 25 to 40 and of this and that, I mean, you can't have the category so wide. So that's why I didn't look at homosexual flirting or anything like that. So I kept it. I feel if you're in a relationship and flirting, and if you're single and you're flirting, you flirt in completely different ways, or maybe for completely different ends.
And you do kind of let people know some of your wisdom, don't you? How can people find out about this?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I run the Flirting and Walking Tours of London, because after living here for 6 years, I started these tours 2 years ago, but I realized people only talk to each other Friday night, Saturday night, pub, club, you know, designated times and places.
That's because alcohol's involved, surely.
Exactly. And but I wanted to show people they're missing out on their everyday experiences. Like, I met my ex, he was sitting outside a cafe in Singapore on a Sunday afternoon. We dated for 5 years. So the point is, you can meet someone anywhere, and that's one of the goals of my tour. Besides, I also teach people my three methods of attack. It's three different ways how to approach people. So...
Okay, and one of the places...
Sneak preview.
Yeah, no, actually, we're dying to know. What are they?
Well, I usually make people come on my tour for that.
Aww, go on, know. Just a little sneak preview of one of them.
All right, just for you. Okay. One of my favorites is Method 2, and this isn't rocket science. I haven't reinvented the wheel, but what I've done, I've packaged it in ways that people can easily understand. So Method 2 is about asking someone a situational question. And this works really well because, one, you're being proactive. You're deciding who you want to ask, oh, have you tried this red wine before? And the other reason why it's really good, well, besides the fact it can be used anywhere, is that you can't lose face. That person doesn't know that you've specifically chosen to ask them, you know, was this a good year for Cabernets?
Right, well, I'll try that out next time. And if anyone out there wants to find out the most erotic vegetable in the vegetable aisle, then go on the tour too. So Jean's going to stick around, I hope. And, well, you know, frankly, we could do with a few tips. Anyway, we'd like to know what you think. Who are the best or indeed the worst flirts around the world? Is there any science to this at all? Or, you know, is it the final mystery that's out there? And especially for Alok, how about sending us the most cringeworthy chat-up lines you've ever used or received? In fact... anyone in the pod, cringeworthy chat-up line. Bobby, you've probably had some cringeworthy chat-up lines in your time.
Are you saying I've delivered them or received them?
Received them, I'm sure.
Well, actually, no. I'm a serial monogamist. I don't flirt.
Okay, that one might... looks like you've got one, Jean.
Well, I have two. This one's my favourite, which I haven't used yet, but I hope I will one day. You must be a parking ticket because you've got fine written all over you. Yeah. And then this one, it was used on me last weekend. Somebody like smelled my hair and then said, I need an estrogen fix. Yeah. Surprise, surprise. I went running in the other direction, but yeah.
Wow. No? Anything to add to that?
I get chatted up.
All right. Okay, well, if anyone else got any other suggestions, send us an email, science@guardian.co.uk, or go and post a comment at our blog, guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts. I'm James Randerson, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, a dramatic fall from space.
She goes to have a conversation with the other woman. But she doesn't shoot her, she doesn't stab her, and there's no evidence that she intended to do anything other than have a talk.
The NASA love triangle that's ended with a charge of attempted murder. We'll tell you all about it just in a minute. Plus, our resident troubadour, Johnny Berliner, will be performing live and exclusive in the pod. But first, The brightest light in the universe has just been switched on, and remarkably, it's nowhere near Las Vegas. In fact, the Diamond Synchrotron is based in a field in Oxfordshire, which is not usually the location for that sort of thing. Bobby, you've been taking a look at this. How bright is this diamond?
It's incredibly bright. In fact, it's the most brilliant light source known to man, which basically means that it's a greater spectrum of super bright light than anything else in the universe. Now, basically, it's a huge particle accelerator which takes packets of millions of electrons, whizzes them up towards the speed of light, and then boshes them around in a 500 meter circumference magnetic ring.
What are they going to use it for?
Well, they want to literally shine a light on some of the tiniest structures known to man. That includes looking at some of the crucial aspects of cell formation and meteorites. But why don't we hear from Gerhard Matalik, who we spoke to last summer in a previous episode of the podcast.
The old synchrotron in the UK, up in Downsbury, which was one of the first ones in the world, really, as a user facility, is a million times less light, less brilliant. And if you imagine, for example, the difference between a 10-watt light bulb and a 100-watt light bulb, that's just one order of magnitude. Mm-hmm. Now we turn on a light bulb, but it's a million times more brilliant. And that will allow us to study really the dark corners of this universe.
Bobby, it sounds expensive. How much is this going to cost?
Well, it's actually the most expensive publicly funded science project that the UK's ever seen. The cost is now around £380 million, and it's been funded mainly from the public. A bit of it comes from the Wellcome Trust. And essentially, you know, this is a good move for the UK, I think. You know, it's a serious piece of kit that they're hoping, you know, can explore some of the things that we don't know anything about.
So, Nell, you've got a question.
Well, it's just, it's amazing that we've got such a big British project. Is there any plans to, is it going to be a solely British scientist working on it, or are we going to get people in from abroad, or how's it going to work?
I think the way these things work is that they're kind of international collaborations. They're building two in sort of concert. There's one in France called Soleil, and they're kind of doing complementary things, and there'll be lots of exchange of scientists and things like that. So, yeah, well, we'll certainly keep up to date with what they discover using the brightest light in the universe. Right, time now for a roundup of the other news from the worlds of science and technology in our new and improved News Jam. First up, Bobby, childhood diseases are on the rise.
This is a study which looked at nearly 700,000 young people over the course of a decade and found that Tourette's syndrome and hyperkinetic disorder were among the disorders which had really increased over the time span. Now, it looked at data from 1990 to 1999. Over that time, Tourette's syndrome more than doubled, hyperkinetic disorder nearly tripled at the age of five. These could be really interesting results. What they're still trying to determine really is, you know, the fine balance between maybe there being environmental factors or about the way we live that actually increase these things, or whether it's just a case of, you know, better reporting, better diagnostics. Now, there was a report, a study in 2005 that looked at things using the same diagnostic criteria over a course of time, and that showed that the incidence of autism in this case didn't really increase. So it's still up for debate, but it's raising some interesting questions.
But let's move on to a very different story, Bobby. One astronaut's career which may have come down to Earth with a bit of a bump.
Yeah, well, I'm sure nobody can have failed to have seen this story about Lisa Novak, the NASA astronaut who had a bit of a turn for the worse and ended up caught in a love triangle and took a trip across America, basically, to get herself into some trouble. She's been charged with attempted first-degree murder after going all the way from Houston to Orlando to allegedly attack her love rival.
And presumably NASA have... I mean, don't they have procedures to weed out people who may be sort of slightly fragile in this way?
Well, I think this is one of the things that's really interested people. I mean, there are some details in the case itself which we all know about that have made the eyebrows raise, but also, you know, NASA astronauts are notorious for almost being robotic because the psychological profiling and testing is meant to weed out anyone with, you know, the hint of a emotional problem or flaw.
There's one other thing to this story. How did she keep driving for 1,000 miles?
Oh, well, the thing that piqued people's interest was really that she kind of applied the efficiency and the training she'd had as an astronaut to rather nefarious ends and, you know, drove across America wearing a nappy so she didn't have to make any toilet stops, which is, you know, one of the tricks they use when taking off in the space shuttle, you know, to stop any nasty accidents.
Now, we're very privileged to be joined by Ian Sample, who's now a sometimes rare visitor of the pod. Tell us about a revolutionary new brain scanning technique, or did you already know what I was going to say?
Well, let me tell you what this isn't before I tell you what it is. It's not a technique which allows you to delve inside someone's brain and read their thoughts, which I think a lot of people will probably interpret it as. But it's something very different. What they've done is they've if you know the brain activity that is associated with two different plans, two different intentions to do something, these guys can go in and they can say, we think you're planning to do that. And in this case, it was planning to either add numbers or subtract them. But what's interesting about it is where this leads, and that this is another small step towards a really interesting direction for neuroscience, I think, in that just comes down to knowing more and more and interpreting more and more about what's going on in the brain.
So the notion that you know, we're into some kind of Minority Report future where we get charged with crimes before we've even committed them is just hocus pocus at the moment.
At the moment, definitely. But the strange thing is, I mean, I talked to 3 or 4 neuroscientists in the area, and they all mention that independently, that it's not implausible stuff, which is time to grapple with the ethics of that, I think.
Well, I'm sure you've all predicted that that's the end of the news jam. Thanks very much, folks. I'm James Randerson, and unless something terrible has happened, you're still listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. We're about halfway through the show, but don't go anywhere. We've still got plenty more talk about science, love, sex, and death to come. With me in the studio, Bobby Johnson and Nell Bowes, as well as our producer, Ben Green. And we're also joined by cultural anthropologist and real-life American, Gene Smith. But Science Weekly is officially the only science podcast in the iTooniverse with our own in-house musician. You've heard him before in the pod, and now, sir, the pod is all yours again. Welcome back, Mr. Johnny Berliner.
Oh, thank you very much.
Hey! So, I'm sure life has changed considerably for you since you've been coming on the pod.
Drastically, yes. Now I'm a megastar.
And what sort of things have our fans been saying to you?
Well, I've met a chap called Gerald Berliner from New York. I said we're going to go out for a drink if ever I go over there. And
are you going to take him up on that?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I always like to meet a namesake. And then there was Darwin D from Falmouth in Cornwall. We've had a little discussion about the philosophy of consciousness over MySpace. That was fun.
Wow.
Yeah, it's non-stop.
What conclusion did you come to?
Actually, I need to reply and destroy his last point. Sorry, Darwin.
Okay. And any groupies out there?
Oh, plenty, yeah. And now I know how to flirt with them.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. Thanks for that. And do keep listening, though, because Johnny will be playing something a little special for us later in the show. And if you haven't heard his stuff before, go to guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts and check out our last show of 2006 and the first one of 2007. Or you can go to myspace/Johnny Berliner. Fantastic. Now, what right do archaeologists have to dig up bones that are hundreds or even thousands of years old? It's an inconvenient question for scientists, and one that seems to be cropping up more and more regularly. At the end of 2006, you may remember that the Natural History Museum gave back some human remains to Aboriginal communities in Australia. Now, requests for reburial are coming from closer to home, with pagan groups in the UK asking for some pre-Christian human remains to be returned. They believe the bones are literally human ancestors, or living ancestors even, and by keeping them, scientists are offending their faith. Well, I spoke to Emma Restall-Orr. She's a druid and head of Honouring the Ancient Dead, an organisation that campaigns for pagan remains to be treated more respectfully by museums. I asked her what the organisation wanted to see happen.
Honouring the Ancient Dead is an advocacy group for human remains of pre-Christian or clearly pagan provenance, where we are ensuring that there is sanctity expressed in the way that these human remains are treated, and also artifacts that go with those human remains in terms of burial. So our position could be summed up by saying we're simply looking for a respectful attitude, respect towards the bones and respect towards the fact that those bones are sacred to pagans.
I guess for some scientists, the issue here comes down to your phrase of tribal connection. Some people might say, you know, that there's no evidence that there is either a cultural or genetic connection between pagans today and people who had, you know, similar beliefs back then.
The tribe, in a pagan sense, is the community with whom we share environment, ecology, understanding, morality. The tribe that looks after us, that guides us, that we care for, that we guide. It's a sense of family, a sense of community. And we have that in different ways. We look after, we have a tribe in our family, we have a tribe amongst our people. As a nation, we have a tribe amongst our village if it's under threat by some development. You know, we cast around ourselves this sense of, you know, we're at one with these other people. That's the sense that is used in paganism. So a sense of the tribe is the people who we feel are our ancestors. And again, we're going back to an understanding that this is a religious sensitivity, not a science that you can prove. Let's move away from this supposition that pagans have to claim anything or have to prove that that claim is valid. It's a religious sensitivity, which is about we are the people of this land. This is our heritage. These are our ancestors or the ancestors of this land. This land is our home. We care for it. It cares for us. And that's the root of our religion.
Do you understand scientists who say, you know, that there are fantastic stories and important discoveries that can be made by studying these human remains, and by burying them, there will be, you know, very important knowledge perhaps lost to future generations?
Yes, I can understand that entirely. And in some cases, I would say that would be valid and true. But I would like to suggest different ways of approaching that. First of all, in some circumstances, and I would say they would be I know of many archaeologists who would agree with me, it is the minority of cases that could be true, that bones exhumed now or in the past may still have or may in the future have scientific value for research. It is the minority of cases. The majority, in terms of the human remains which are in store in museums, there is not sufficient context, documentation, clarity about where the bones come from, or they are too contaminated to have clear scientific value now. And those bones are the ones that we need to discuss more clearly.
That was Emma Restall-Orr from Honouring the Ancient Dead. Bobby, you've got a question.
Yeah, well, I'm going to throw it straight back to you, actually, James, because I know you've been looking into this quite carefully. But what do scientists actually think about this?
Well, a lot of them are not very keen on the idea of giving back loads of data that they might be able to use. That's kind of their feeling on it. And they feel, you know, that there's no way of proving a connection between these people who are claiming these bones now and the people who died. But there are several museums that are actually, you know, in dialogue with Honouring the Ancient Dead, including Manchester and some of the museums in Leicester. So there are kind of mixed views in the museum community, I think.
And, I mean, Emma there said, we are the people of this land, sort of implies that there's one pagan movement that's asking for them back, but surely that can't be the case, as far as I understand it.
That's right. There isn't sort of one movement. In fact, we kind of fell foul of this, because I quoted another group called the Council of British Druid Orders, and then subsequent to writing the article, had a whole load of letters from people claiming that they were the real Council of British Druid Orders. It was all a bit kind of, you know, the people's front of Judea.
Yeah, it's all just a bunch of splitters, really. They seem to argue amongst themselves a lot.
Yeah, but there are varying degrees of opinion within the pagan community, and she would probably argue that we're all the people of this land, and in some sense we're all their ancestors. So
yeah, but surely that's Johnny. Quite a tough line to take when most of the people in Britain are sort of interbreeds of Angles and Saxons and Frisians and all people from all over Europe and all over the world, and have been for a long time, mainly since the Romans, and the Romans kind of stopped or put an end to a lot of Druidism. And I mean, how do we really know that these people are the ancestors?
I mean, I think their point is that they would accept, in a kind of scientific sense, they're not the ancestors, but they would say our religious belief is that we are connected with the land, and the land is a kind of a thing which goes on, and those people are on the land too, and those remains, human remains, are part of the land, and therefore we're connected with them. Now, whether scientists should listen to that is kind of an open question, really, but. I'd be really interested to hear what those in Podland have to think about this. I mean, do religious beliefs trump scientists' right to do research? Or should museums simply ignore people with no provable connection to the bones in their collections? Email us at science@guardian.co.uk or post a comment on the blog at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts. Now, speaking of blogs, ours went into overdrive a little bit last week. One issue got you particularly hot under the collar. We'll come to that one in a minute, but first, a mea culpa. Some of you on the blog have pointed out that Dr. Aubrey de Grey, the man who thinks we should all be living to 1,000 and was our guest last week, doesn't have an academic position at Cambridge University. Now, that was a mistake on our part, so sorry about that. Let's be clear, Aubrey doesn't have an academic position at Cambridge, but he did used to work for the university, and he does have a PhD, and he has published in the field of ageing. So, and he also has a fantastic beard. So, sorry about that. We'll try better next time. But, at least Lightning enjoyed our interview, saying...
I don't know what all the fuss is about, really. I'm 1,006 and still going strong. I put it down to a Barocca in the morning and keeping up to my daily target of 20 Bensons.
Now, the other topic we dealt with on last week's show was the news that Perry Farrell was releasing a single based on climate change using lyrics from a Jim Morrison poem. So we asked whether rock stars had any business getting involved with climate change. And, you know, well, we thought we'd handled the debate with the levity and, well, dare I say it, derision it deserved. So for those of you out there who've had an irony bypass, for the record, we also think the idea that Jim Morrison predicted climate change is a pretty laughable PR stunt. Well, at the same time, we managed to clearly upset a lot of Doors fans. They've posted comments that suggest, well, A, they didn't really listen to the show, and B, they're also into mildly hallucinogenic drugs. Well, not that there's much wrong with that. But anyway, the posts are mostly too weird to read out, I'm afraid, but one of them is summed up quite well by Radio Vilcabamba.
Jim Morrison was a cosmic shaman. Reading these posts, all I have to say is, people are strange, so... show me the way to the next whiskey bar.
And Mr. Marrow?
Jim Morrison, ha! Why not ask Meatloaf for a pithy quote next? Or maybe get the whole of King Crimson on for a chat.
So, we hope we've got that sorted. And in case anyone's wondering, you know, whether we're prepared to get into fights with fans of rock stars, Bobby's still got the scars on his back from his fight with some status quo fans. Tell us about that, Bobby.
Yeah, I made the mistake one time of on the technology blog of getting saying something nasty about status quo, and then got absolute hordes of them coming after me, the fans giving me a hard time. Which I'm happy to say I shrugged off, and I still hate status quo, and I still hate status quo fans.
Oh, how dare you, Bobby. All I can recommend people is that you go back and listen for yourself to last week's programme. Listen particularly from 16 minutes into the show, not least because you'll hear me singing. Okay, so that's it for our sort of Valentine's Day special edition of Science Weekly. My thanks to everyone in the pod, Bobby Johnson and Nell Bowes, and our special guest, Gene Smith. Science Weekly's producer is Ben Green. I've been James Randerson, and this is the magnificent Johnny Berliner. See you next time.
Well, I used to take sugar, a lump maybe two. I'd only eat sweets when an apple would do. I would only spread honey until there was you. 'Cause you got all the sweetness I need.
Well, you know I get bitter when you go away. I never get sick just as long as you stay. You give me my kicks, help me work, rest and play. Cause you got all the sweetness I need. Lord knows I never got on with the dentist. He told me my teeth would rot away, but I know now. If I got your sweetness, I don't need no sugar, so my teeth will be okay. Well, your chocolatey lips give a caramel grin. Whenever you kiss me, I need a shot of insulin. I'm almost diabetic when you're doing your thing. Cause you got all the sweetness I need. Lord knows I never got on with a dentist. He told me my teeth would rot away, and I know now. If I got your sweetness, I don't need no sugar, so my teeth will be okay. Well, I used to eat sugar, a lump maybe two. I'd only eat sweets when an apple would do. I would only spread honey until there was you. Cause you got all the sweetness I need. Yeah, you got all the sweetness I need. Yeah, you got all the sweetness I need. Woo!
Guardian Unlimited.